Good morning, afternoon,
And I'll just
wherever
post,
you are. It's all right. Go
sorry, the
ahead.
source sheets will be posted in just a moment.
Okay. I would be remiss if I didn't take this opportunity to wish a mazel tov to Rabbi Kelman and to his family on the forthcoming marriage this Sunday of his son, on account of which he is, if I understand correctly, presently somewhere in the Rocky Mountains. Mazal tov on my behalf, and I'm sure on behalf of everybody else. Something else to point out, partially on account of the fact that I had to miss a week because of a professional responsibility, and partially because there was some ambiguity about exactly when Elul begins, we will be concluding this class next Thursday. So while I think that the official Torah in Motion Elul series will not have begun yet, so we're kind of a twilight zone. So next Thursday morning at the same time, we'll have the concluding class in this series on Maimonides, a Man of Letters, in which we will use the opportunity to look not as we have been until now at his rather lengthy letters that amount as much to monographs as they do to actual correspondence, but we'll have a look at some of his more brief correspondences. And with that, let me take us to today's subject. Okay, which is the treatise on resurrection, the Mamar on Tchiyat HaMetim. I don't know whether it's ironic or significant that in the late part of the 12th century, there could be such a vibrant controversy surrounding something as abstract as Tchiyat HaMetim, as the resurrection. But as we will indeed see, it has been a constant subject of speculation and of controversy on the part of Jewish authorities. So let's start off with something somewhat more mundane. Okay, here is, as I'm sure you'll all recognize, the opening passage in the Siddur. Arguably then, the opening prayer of the day, which I should add parenthetically, is actually a bit of a paradox, because as you know, halachically, the day does not begin with the morning. The day begins with the evening. So technically speaking, the first prayer of any day is Ma'ariv. Now, what makes it a paradox, or what sharpens the paradox, is that I'm not acquainted really with any Siddur that starts with Ma'ariv. Just about every Siddur I've ever seen starts with Shacharit, as opposed, let's say, to Machzorim. Machzorim that are intended for use on holidays do actually begin, not only do they begin with Ma'ariv, of the eve of the holiday, but they even start, many of them, with mincha of the previous afternoon. So machzorim are actually more in tune with the halachic perception of prayer than sidurim are. Now, of course, since sidurim are more venerable than machzorim and considerably better represented in terms of the history of Jewish printing, of course, it just raises the question, which I have no intention of answering here and now, as to why Sidurim don't begin with Ma'ariv, but begin rather with Shacharit. Okay, I've given you something to think about. With that, here is, as I said, what everybody recognizes as the tefillah, the prayer that launches at least the morning service. And it is, Modea o Moda ani lefanecha, I express my gratitude before you, you being Melech Chai v'Kayam, a living and eternal king. And for what am I grateful? shehechezarta bi nishmati, that you have restored my soul. Arguably then, this prayer says that the soul is restored on a daily basis. Now, if somebody is bereft of his soul and the soul has to be returned or restored to him, then what is he in the interim? In the interim, he is dead. Now, just a bit later in the daily service, we recite this prayer, in which we say, Elohai, right, addressing God, Nishama shenatata bi, the soul that you have invested in me, tehorahi, is pure. Ata, you God, vrata yitzarta, you created it, you formed or fashioned it, nefachta bi, you inspired me with it, literally, you blew it into me, mishamrab kirbi, you preserve it in within me. And now, vaata, atid litla mimeni, that you one day in the future, you will take my soul. And then after you will take my soul, lahachazirah bi leatid lavo, and then at some yet future time, you will restore it to me. So indeed, there's a bit of a contradiction here between these two early morning prayers. In the first one, we thank God for the daily restoration of our souls, right? Which, as I said, seems somewhat odd, because if our soul has to be restored to us, then that implies that prior to its restoration, we were dead. Right? That may have once been some sort of folk belief that at night people really are dead, and they not only awaken in the morning, but they essentially are resurrected in the morning, right? But this longer prayer is somewhat more in tune with what we would consider to be the situation, and that is that while we are alive, throughout our lives, we possess the soul that was inspired in us when we were born, and that it is only ultimately at the end of our lives that this soul will be taken from us. And then we acknowledge that even at some subsequent point to that, after death, the soul will yet be restored to us. Now, this whole concept of the restoration of the soul, of what's called the resurrection of the dead, right, is also something that, as we see, is dependent upon an association with some future period of time. Now, curiously, if I can lift yet another prayer out of the Siddur, this one from the Shabbat morning service, okay, there is not one, but actually four different eras or periods of time that we speak of as being in the future. We say, Ein kirkacha Hashem Eloheinu ba'olam hazeh. There is none like you, God, in this world. Ein zulatcha, there is none comparable to you when in olam haba, a world that does not yet exist, the world to come. Ephes piltacha, there is none apart from you when in something called Yemot HaMashiach, the Messianic Age. And finally, in Dom Elecha, there is none comparable to you when, during another period of time called Chiyat HaMeter. And indeed, as the late Rabbi Sacks pointed out in his translation and commentary of the Koren Siddur, the prayer itemizes four time zones. This world, Olam Hazeh, that we inhabit now, the world to come, Olam Haba, which, according to Maimonides, and that's where we're headed, right, is the realm of the soul after death. Okay. The third, Yemot HaMashiach, the days of the Messiah, when the temple will be rebuilt, the rule of David will be restored, peace and justice will prevail in the affairs of mankind. And only in the fourth time zone, right, Tchiyat HaMetim, the resurrection of the dead, the final denouement of history, when those who have died will live again. So Olam Haba is not the period of time in which the souls are restored, at least not according to this four-part division. Olam Haba, to borrow from Maimonides, is again a transition period in which souls are alive, but they have not yet been reunited with the bodies that they once occupied. That reunion, so to speak, of body and soul takes place only at a later period of time called the era of Triyat HaMetim, of the resurrection. And this, in fact, comes from the Mishnah is our source for this, or at least for part of it. Famous Mishnah at the beginning of the 10th Perek of Sanhedrin. Kol Yisrael yesh lahem chelek la'olam haba. That all Jews have a share in the world to come. Now remember, we've seen the Maimonidean definition of the world to come. The Maimonidean definition of Olam Haba, the world to come, remember, is a world that's occupied only by souls and not by bodies. That isn't, as we will see, the exclusive, or for that matter, even the consensus opinion. Okay, and there's a biblical verse from which this is derived, somewhat homiletically, Va'amech kulam tzadikim, that the Jewish people consists entirely of righteous people, La'olam yirshu aretz, and they will inherit the earth for all eternity. Netzer mata'ai masei adai lehitpa'er, they're the work of God's hand, so to speak, in order to glorify his name. And then the Mishnah, again, as is well known, inverts the original statement that promises a share in the world to come to all Jews, and it begins to enumerate individuals or categories of Jews who lose their share in the world to come. But again, that's not our focus for today. So this is the famous Mishnah that introduces us to the concept of Olam Haba. And from that moment on, we find Jewish philosophers speculating on just what Olam Haba is. Okay? How does it relate to Tchiyat HaMetim? So here we have a selection from the 7th chapter of the Book of Beliefs and Opinions, the Sefer HaEmunot VaHadayot of Sa'adya Gaon. The entire 7th chapter is devoted by him to the subject of the world to come and the resurrection. And he declares that as far as the doctrine of resurrection of the dead is concerned, he maintains that it is a matter upon which our nation is in complete agreement. Okay? Meaning that no Jews take exception to the idea that there will ultimately be a Tchiyat HaMetim. The basis of this conclusion is a premise, namely, that man is the goal of all creation. The reason why he, man, has been distinguished above all other creatures is, of course, that he might serve God. Now, if he serves God, then he's entitled to a reward. And the reward for this service is life eternal in the world of recompense. Life eternal is Tchiyat HaMetim, the resurrection of the dead. In the world of recompense, that would be the world to come or the Messianic age. Sa'adya also stipulates that prior to this event, right, that is, prior to this reunion of body and soul in the world to come, whenever he sees fit to do so, God separates man's spirit from his body, right? That is to say, people die, right? Until how long will mortals continue to be subject to death? Until the time when the number of souls meant to be created has been fulfilled. This isn't necessarily a logical proposition, right? But Saadia apparently maintained that since everything has a purpose, then truly creation has a purpose too. And therefore, there must be some ideal situation wherein there will be the ideal number of people alive or the ideal number of people who have ever lived. And once we reach that ideal stage, right, then life as we are acquainted with it in this world will cease, whereupon God brings about the union of all bodies and souls again. Meaning, once we reach, let's call that the tipping point, the point at which the earth will have been populated by as many, by the ideal number of people, okay, so that there is no longer any point or purpose in new life being created, okay. So at that point, God will bring about the reunion of all of the bodies and all of the souls of anyone who has ever lived. And he concludes this section by saying, we do not know of any Jew who would disagree with this belief. So again, the belief that at some point in time, under certain circumstances that we cannot really describe with any accuracy, God is in fact capable of and will be inclined to reunite the bodies of all of those who have lived with their souls is regarded as the unanimous opinion, not just of Jewish philosophers, but of all Jews. Okay. That doesn't mean that there weren't or aren't disagreements regarding the details. So here we have a passage from a relatively late work of Jewish philosophy, early 15th century, Rabbi Yosef Albo. The book written originally in Hebrew is called Sefer HaIkarim, the Book of Principles. And in it, he has a rather lengthy discussion of the different opinions pertaining to the resurrection of the dead. And it begins, as you see here, by his maintaining that ha'emunah, the belief, b'tchiyat ha'meitim, in resurrection of the dead, ru'uya, it's a worthy belief, u'mechuyevet, and it is obligatory, l'fi kabbalat ha'umah, according to the traditions of the Jewish people. And he goes on and he says, let's just stick to the English on account of the constraints of time, okay? That even though, again, this is not something that necessarily proceeds from logic, but since it is something whose existence is rationally conceivable, meaning logic doesn't necessarily oblige us to accept it, but neither, on the other hand, does it contradict it. Okay? Therefore, he says we are obliged to believe it as we have explained. Particularly is the case since it is confirmed by experience. Namely, we know from the book of Kings, from Sefer Melachim, that the prophet Elijah, Eliyahu HaNavi, brought back to life the son of the widow of Tsarfat. His disciple Elisha HaNavi revived the son of the Shunammite woman. And the thing to which experience testifies, meaning something that somebody at some point observed with one of his, senses, must be believed, even if it is not required by logic. And he gives an example of something else to which experience testifies, even if it is not required by logic. And the example that he gives is that there's a stone which attracts iron, right? A magnet, because experience shows it, though logic does not require it. Meaning, we must therefore believe the same way that we know that magnets attract iron, even though this is not necessarily a logical premise, we must therefore believe that God will revive the dead even after they turn to dust, because it is something that the mind can conceive. Okay, logic doesn't compel it, But on the other hand, neither does it rule it out. The resurrection must be explained in the same way. The body of the righteous man, by reason of the impression remaining in it of the divine spirit which it lodged, is more prepared without doubt to receive the same divine spirit a second time than it was at first. Meaning that same earthly corpus that was the vessel into which the soul was inspired, okay, by virtue of having served as to accommodate the soul during that person's initial lifetime, is now probably better prepared to assume that same responsibility the second time around. In other words, a thing which was not fit to receive a higher power, that is an earthly body, and yet it received it once, is surely fit to receive it a second time. Why? Because it retains the impression that was made on it initially, and the preparation for receiving it a second time more easily than the first. So again, as he says, this is not logically compelling, but neither is it logically inconceivable. As to the manner of resurrection, derech hatchiyah, how does God cause bodies that had turned into dust to come back into existence? The rabbis say that there is a certain dew, tal, with which God will revive the dead. It seems, therefore, that the dew which God will cause to descend upon the earth will have in it the virtue of the semen of the male, which gives the form of the person, while the earth at that time, by reason of its preparation, will have the virtue of the seed of the female, which gives the matter of the newly born individual. And therefore, as he maintains, was prophesied by Ezekiel concerning the dead, which he brought back to life. Okay, that's not to be regarded as a contradiction. Indeed, if we interpret the text literally, and indeed, as we'll see in a moment, the question of whether texts such as the book of Ezekiel are to be taken literally or figuratively is basically the crux of the difference of opinion between Maimonides and others. Maimonides in general tended to see things more figuratively and metaphorically, while other philosophers and scholars had a tendency, greater tendency, to see those things literally. But one thing before we move on, and that is the question of God's use of tal, of dew, in order to effect the resurrection. If you are acquainted with, or if you will open a machzor for the holiday of Pesach, and you look at the prayer that we insert into Musaf of the first day called Tfilat Tal, okay, you'll see this notion somewhat elaborated. Namely, just as dew brings life to the grass on which it falls in the morning, right? It's not the sole means of irrigation. It isn't even necessarily the principal means of irrigation. Not nearly as much moisture is available through dew as is produced by rain, but nonetheless, it provides a measure of irrigation, right? Just as, therefore, you'll see in the piyutim, in the liturgical poems that accompany the prayer of Tal, you'll see the predominance there of the word lahachayot, to bring to life. But we don't have to go as far as one of the holiday prayers in order to see this connection. We can see it, in fact, in one of our daily prayers. Actually, to be more correct, not one of our daily prayers, but three of our daily prayers. Which prayer do we recite thrice daily? Yes, the Amidah, Shmoneh Esrei. And indeed, if you take a look, there are, as we have mentioned on a previous occasion, three brachot at the beginning of every Amidah that are called Birchot HaShevach, prayers in praise of God, just as there are comparably three brachot at the conclusion of every Amidah that are designated Hodayah, thanksgiving, right? It's only in the middle section of the Amidah that things change from weekdays to Shabbat, and from Shabbat to the Shalosh Regalim, and from the Shalosh Regalim to the Yamim HaNoraim. The first three brachot, the first one is Avot, right? That bracha in which, according to most of the sources, primarily Rambam, one is obliged to have kavana when approaching prayer. Okay. The second one, right, is called Magen Avot. Okay. And if you look to see, the third bracha, it includes the bracha, the concluding bracha is Mechaye HaMetim. Okay? And what do you find in the bracha that concludes with Mechaye HaMetim? That's the place which in the winter we insert the phrase, in praise of God, Mashiv HaRuach Umorid HaGeshem. Or the place where in the summertime, we replace that, or at least according to some of the versions of Tfilah, we replace it with Morid Hatal. So we see that the editors or redactors of the Sidur somehow understood, either actively or intuitively, that there is a connection between dew and rain on the one hand, and Tchiyat HaMetim, the resurrection of the dead, on the other hand. And that is why even the Talmud was already aware of this and informed us that the prayer for rain should be incorporated in the bracha of Mechaye HaMetim. And you can see, as I said, the similarity between the two concepts. Moisture, whether it's dew or rain, brings life to things that grow, right? And therefore, it serves as a model for the restoration of bodies and souls in the future. However, be that as it may, Rabbi Albo continues, and he points out, he says, that there is some difference of opinion, right? Be that as it may, whether after the resurrection, meaning after people's bodies and souls are reunited, the question is, do people then resume a mortal existence? Do they eat and drink and beget children? And once again, if they are restored to their previous mortal existence, they will once again die in the usual manner? Or whether what will follow the resurrection of the dead, the restoration of the souls to their bodies, is not a resumption of their prior physical existence, right? He says, we have already explained that it is a matter of dispute among the great men of more recent times. Meaning, we can't really find discussions of this in classical rabbinic literature, in the Talmud or even in the Midrash, but he says it is something on which medieval philosophers have speculated. And he gives us some of these opinions, including, of course, that of Maimonides. And he tells us, Maimonides and a great many distinguished men who follow him say that the persons resurrected will use all their sense functions in the natural way, meaning they will resume a completely mortal existence, and then will die again and return to dust. As I said, once they've been restored essentially to a corporeal, physical existence, right? Then just as they once died, they will again die. However, he tells us that a certain Rabbi Meir Halevi, that's the Rama, not the Rama, Rabbi Moses Isterlis of Poland, but Rabbi Meir Halevi of Spain, and Nachmanides, Ramban, are of a different opinion, They're of the opinion that after the resurrection, the persons in question will live as long as their natural capacity permits them, but then their bodies will be transmuted by purification and will become like the body of Elijah. Now, you may remember that Elijah, like Moses, went up to the top of Mount Horeb and lasted for 40 days and 40 nights without eating bread or drinking water. So that apparently he, at least for those 40 days, existed in a different kind of corporeal existence than the one that we are acquainted with. Okay, so he gives some details and he says, then, right, thenceforth, they will continue to exist as body and soul, but will no longer use any sense functions, meaning they will not eat or drink or die. They will remain forever without eating and drinking. It seems too, Albo says, that this latter opinion, the one espoused by Rabbi Meir Halevi and by the Rambam, is the opinion of some of the rabbis of the Talmud, and he quotes those rabbis as saying that the righteous whom God will resurrect will not return to dust. So we can see that one of the more contentious points surrounding the matter of resurrection is the question of, okay, so there will be a resurrection, okay? It's not compelled, it's not logically compelling, but on the other hand, neither is it logically unacceptable. But after this reunion of bodies and souls, what happens? Okay. Now, this is what we all know and recognize as being Rambam, or at least the most pithy formulation of Maimonides' opinion on the subject. It is the final, the 13th of his 13 articles of faith. Ani ma'amin b'emuna shlema, to believe in a flawless, perfect faith, shetiyeh tchiyat ha-meitim, that indeed there will be this reunion of bodies and souls, when ve'et she'ya'ale ratzon me'et ha-bore yitbarach shemo, when at the time that God sees fit for it. Some more details are provided by Rambam in his Mishneh Torah, in Hilchot Tshuvah, in which he says, and again, on account of the constraints of time, right, the world to come harbors neither body, ein bo guf, nor aught of a concrete form, geviyah, right? Nothing corporeal, ella, rather, what is there in the world to come? Only the souls of the righteous divested of body, as are the ministering angels. Now, we've already seen this. Remember, we saw the definition, Maimonides' definition of the world to come as this transition period in which there is existence only on the level of the souls prior to the restoration of bodies, of physical bodies. So again, he says, in this period of time called Olam Haba, right, souls exist without accompanying bodies. And in that respect, he says, they are kemal achei hasharet, they are comparable to ministering angels. However, therefore, inasmuch as it harbors no concrete forms, therefore, he says, there is no need in Olam Haba for eating, drinking, or any of the bodily necessities of mortals in this world. Neither will any of the many things which happen to bodies in this world come to pass there. As for instance, there's no such thing as sitting down, standing up, going to sleep. There's no death, there's no sadness, no mirth or the like, because all of those things are physical properties. And he maintains that this is the position of the Talmud, and he cites a Gemara in Brachot, Haolam Haba, Ein Bo Lo Achila Velo Shtia. Right? In the world to come, there will be no need or purpose for any of these physical activities, not eating, not drinking, not no family life or the like. Ella, so what will there be in the world to come? Tzadikim yoshevim, the righteous are present. Va'atrotehem barashehem, and they are crowned to signify their status, their stature. V'nehenin miziva shechina, and they enjoy the radiance of the divine presence. Hare, it's clear, he says, that no bodies, nothing corporeal exists in the world to come, seeing that there is neither eating nor drinking. So this is clear from the Talmudic passage as well. In fact, he says, you might have thought that there's some sort of a contradiction, because he maintained that just as there is no eating and drinking, there's also no standing or sitting. And yet it referred to the righteous being seated in the presence of God. So he explains, Zeshamru tzadikim yoshvim, this expression that the righteous will be seated, he says, it's figurative. It's as if they meant to say that they are there without effort or fatigue. And since the phrase they employed, saying va'atrotehem barashehem, right, that they are crowned, means that they have conscious knowledge of the reason why they have merited to be in the world to come. And this is their crown of garlands. Citing a verse in Shir HaShirim, ba'atara she'etralo imo, the crown that his mother wove for him. And it also speaks in the book of Yeshayahu about Simchat Olam al Rosham, literally that perpetual or eternal joy will rest upon their heads. So he points out, he says, joy is not a body to rest upon one's head. Even so, the crown spoken of by the sages refers to what? So what does it mean to have joy upon your head? It refers to knowledge. But what is the meaning of the phrase that they indulge in feasting upon the radiance of the Shekhinah? Isn't this something physical or corporeal? So he says, no, this too is intellectual. It is means by which they know and attain part of the truth of the Holy One, blessed be he, something that they cannot know while they are purely corporeal. So to Maimonides, again, as I said, all of these expressions that are in rabbinic literature that, if taken literally, would imply physical corporeal existence, were not meant to be taken literally. They were meant to be understood figuratively or metaphorically. And here we see the opposite opinion. Many of the of Maimonides' legal rulings in the Mishneh Torah were challenged by a contemporary authority living in France, in Provence, Rabbi Avraham ben David, known as the Ravid, right? After the acronym Aleph Bet Dalet, Avraham ben David. And to not all, but to many of those rulings of Maimonides with which he strenuously disagreed, he appended his strictures called Hasagot. So this is the Hasagah, the stricture, the criticism that Avraham ben David leveled against Maimonides' definition of the world to come as being a place where there was nothing corporeal. So the opening words in Maimonides, to which he is taking exception, are highlighted here in yellow, ha'alam haba ein bo guf, right? Then in the world to come, there is nothing corporeal. The Aleph stands for Amar Avraham, right? Introducing, as I said, something written by Maimonides, but as I said, by this Avraham ben David. And he writes as follows, Divrei ha'ish hazeh, the words of this man, Maimonides, Be'enai, from my perspective, he says, krovim are resemble l'misha omer ein triat hametim legufot ela l'neshamot bilavad. Meaning, his description of the world to come is a period of time in which there is an existence, but the existence is not a corporeal existence. It is purely a spiritual, soulful existence, reminds Abraham ben David of an opinion of someone else who said that, you know, there will not be a physical, corporeal resurrection, but that the whole concept of resurrection applies only to the resurrection of souls and not to the restoration of bodies. V'chaye roshi, he takes an oath. Lo haya da'at chazal al zeh. He says that this opinion surely would have been unacceptable to the sages of the Talmud. How does he know? Shaharei Amru, because he cites a passage in Masechet Ketubot that says, Atidin tzadikim sheya'amidu bilevusheihem. That in the future, the righteous will stand before God in their clothes. And it continues, V'chein hayu mitzadlin livneihem, that these righteous people would, in their last will and testament, would instruct their children, Al tikberuni b'cheilim levanim v'lo v'shchorim shema ezkeh. That they would instruct their children to bury them in white clothing rather than in black clothing, a custom that we perpetuate, right? Because it was indicative of the sense of merit, right? Meaning that they wanted to be clothed in white because they assumed that they would once again need that clothing, okay? Which means that they presumed that there would be not just the rejuvenation or restoration of their souls, but the restoration of their physical bodies as well. The Chayin Amru, and there's another passage in the Talmud that says, Shelo yashuvu hatzadikim le'afar, that the righteous will not turn into dust, ela omdim bigviatam, but they will continue to exist in their corpora, in their bodies. And there's yet in the final passage that says, bimumam omdim umit rapim. It's an interesting question that Saadia Gaon also dealt with in his Emunot V'Dayot. That is that if people were physically disfigured when they were alive, would they be resurrected with those same disfigurements or not? And as you can imagine, there are opinions on both sides of the question. Nevertheless, on account of all of these citations, he says, right? Kolela mochichim, all of these citations prove that they will resume life bodily. But it is possible that God will make their bodies strong and healthy, like those of angels or that of Elijah, right? And furthermore, he says that their crowns will be real and not metaphorical. So indeed, as we see, that all of those Talmudic passages and other ideas that Maimonides took to be figurative or metaphorical, Abraham ben David insisted on their being understood literally. This is the background against which Maimonides wrote his treatise on the resurrection. And here again, as I've been habitually doing, I bring you a cover page, the front page, the opening of the text, this time in manuscript form. And this time, actually, in a manuscript of the original Judeo-Arabic. Okay, Judeo-Arabic, think of it, if you wish, as a great granddaddy of Yiddish, meaning it's a language other than Hebrew that capitalizes on the fact that Jews are all acquainted with the Hebrew alphabet, and therefore they can read the words even in a foreign language without knowing the script of the foreign language. They can read it and understand it by substituting Hebrew characters. So here, the words as you see on the top line, the words on the right-hand side highlighted in yellow are actually, the first two words are Arabic. The third word, the one that's a bit smudged, you can see the letter Tav at the end of it, before the big space, that's the word tchiyat. And then on the other side of that large space is the word hametim. And then you can see the last word on the first line, l'rabbeinu. And then the second line, Moshe, be'rav maimon zecher tzadik livracha. The rest of it is Judeo-Arabic. So this is, as I said, just a way of introducing and reminding us that in this case, as was the case for the previous letter we studied, the Igeret Teiman, and the one that preceded that, the Igeret Hashmad, and indeed probably the major portion of Maimonides' correspondence, was originally in the Arabic language, but using the Hebrew alphabet. And the reason that Maimonides wrote this Mamar Triat HaMetim is because criticism, such as that of Avraham ben David, had also emanated from other sources. As you see my notes at the top of the slide, criticism such as that of Rabbah originated in large measure from one particular person, Rabbi Shmuel ben Eli, who was the Gaon, or Dean of the Yeshiva in Baghdad. He was a contemporary of Maimonides and one of his most implacable opponents. And from Maimonides' reference to Samuel Halevi, Shmuel ben Eli, early on in this treatise on resurrection, we can see that it was, to a certain extent, typical of its time. Namely, as I've been emphasizing, Rabbi Samuel relied on the unadorned and unexplained, the literal sense of the Talmud and Midrash, while Maimonides argued for the necessary qualification of rabbinic legendary material in the light of contemporary philosophical sensibilities, meaning his treatment of these things as figurative or metaphorical rather than literal. And here is the passage in the beginning of his treatise on the resurrection, in which he makes specific reference to his intellectual antagonist. In this year, 1191, a letter arrived from some of my colleagues in Baghdad. I remember that Maimonides was in Fustat in old Cairo in Egypt, in which they wrote that an individual from Yemen inquired regarding these issues, again, regarding the question of the world to come and the messianic age and the resurrection of the dead. But his inquiry was addressed to Rabbi Shmuel Halevi, the incumbent head of the academy. Now notice, despite Maimonides' antagonism towards him, right, he's deferential, may God protect him, right, who at present resides in Baghdad. And in response to this inquiry, this Rabbi Samuel composed an essay on resurrection. And in this essay, he called some of Maimonides' views an error and a sin, but referred to other of his views as defensible. Okay. So again, he took issue with some of Maimonides' views on the subject, but not necessarily with all of them. Maimonides writes, I found it was a collection of homilies and legends that he had gathered, again, that he took things literally. Everyone knows that scholars are not expected to rehearse the homilies and curious tales of the sort that women tell one another in their condolence calls, meaning it's not proper for a scholar of such repute to indulge, he says, in folklore. What is wanted, indeed, is their interpretation. I mean, how are we supposed to understand these rabbinic legends and an exposition of their implied meaning, not the literal meaning, but what they may imply, so that they conform to a rational position, or at least approximate it. And in another letter that he wrote to his son, Abraham, he wrote again about this same Shmuel ben Eli, my son, should you take offense that a man whom people accustomed from his youth to believe that there is none like him in his generation, when age, high office, aristocratic descent, the lack of people of discernment in this town and his relationship with individuals all have combined to produce this execrable consequence, that each and every individual hangs expectantly on each word pronounced from the academy in anticipation of an honorific title. From there, he suggests that the reason that people defer to this Rabbi Samuel is because if you get on his good side, he does favors for you. Why do you wonder, he asks his son, that he's acquired such evil traits? Meaning, we see again, as I said, that Maimonides did not hold this man. He was in respect of the fact that this man occupied a position of importance in the Jewish community, but thought that perhaps that he was unworthy of it to a certain respect. And we see again throughout that Maimonides attributed the misunderstanding to an oversimplification by the masses of the doctrine of resurrection, similar to that oversimplification that determined their view of anthropomorphism. And he wrote again in his treatise, all this is an inescapable consequence of premature misconceptions in the minds of the masses. They, the masses, do not recognize true existence other than in a body. For this reason, most of them believe that God is corporeal, because in their judgment, he would not be in existence if he were not. And yet this too was one of Maimonides' 13 articles of faith. Ani mamin b'emunah shlema, again to believe in a flawless faith, shabore yidbarach shemo, that God exalted eino guf. He is not corporeal. And because he is not corporeal, lo yasiguhu masigei haguf. Physical attributes cannot be applied to him literally. And again, as I've said on any number of previous occasions, Maimonides reminds us that the most ubiquitous metaphor in the Bible is Vayedaber Hashem. That because God, strictly speaking, does not have lungs, does not have a throat, does not have a mouth, does not have a tongue, does not have lips, right? God cannot speak, right? As I said again, unfortunately, the Torah just doesn't seem to have the equivalent of a verb for communicate. If it did, it might have spared us a bit of anxiety, and it might have said that God didn't speak to Moses, but that God communicated with him. But Maimonides understands that because God is not corporeal, he could not speak, and therefore the idea of God speaking must be understood metaphorically. All said, however, parts of the Moreh HaNivuchim, parts of Maimonides' Mishneh Torah, such as the passages I brought here from Hilchot Tshuvah on the nature of the world to come, and parts of this letter that Maimonides wrote on the subject of the resurrection of the dead, were so rejected by some Jewish authorities that in the year 1232, portions of these works of Maimonides were burned. I don't have the expertise to narrow it down further than this. I can tell you that there is some, to the best of my knowledge, there is some contradictions within the sources as to whether the burning took place at the behest of Jews, but that it was actually perpetrated by Gentile authorities. Okay. It's also unclear because of, again, different sources or the interpretations of different sources, whether this burning took place in Montpellier in Provence or in Marseille, or in perhaps confusing it with another instance, historical instance of the burning of the Talmud, whether it took place in Paris, okay? But somewheres in France, not long after Maimonides' death, a generation after Maimonides died, we find books or portions of books written by Maimonides consigned to the flames because other Jews found them to be unacceptable. And with that, we conclude, and let me have a look at the chat. Sleep, you know, 60th is a typological percentage. For example, if you visit someone who is ill, okay, bikur cholim, then it's said that you remove 1/60th of his illness. So the idea of it being 1/60th of death is probably just, again, if I'm looking at it from a Menidian perspective, it's a way of saying, you know something, when you're asleep, there's something in the nature of being asleep, of reposing asleep, that's similar to reposing, as it were, in a coffin or in a grave. Okay.
I just meant to bring up that there was a connection between.
Yes, yes. As I said, there's certainly a folk connection. You certainly, again, this can be measured scientifically, right? You don't breathe as often or as deeply when you're asleep as you do when you're awake. So clearly, and remember again that the soul, there are three expressions in Hebrew for the soul, right? All of which have something to do with respiration. With respiration, right? Ruach, nefesh, neshama, all have to do with respiration. Okay. So as I said, it's something that is both, you know, you can observe empirically, right? And hence the association. Okay. If sleep was death halachically, then no sin or punishment for killing an already dead man, may respect for a corpse. I thought it was going someplace else. I'm going to say if sleep was death, then if you killed somebody while they were asleep, maybe you wouldn't have committed murder. But that's somewhat, you know, I think that's really reductio ad absurdum. But indeed, you know, you can't, so far as I know, according to Jewish law, as well as according to common law, you can't kill a dead person. Mechaye Amitim only prays for a slight challenge to God. It's praise. I don't think it's a challenge. The morning passage of Ata Nishamash and Atata be Ata Tidlitlami Menu Lahachzi Rabbi, that could be seen more as of a challenge. But Baruch Ata Shemachaye Hametim, I think, strictly speaking, is just praise. World to come and world yet to come. There's a distinction maybe in English. There's no distinction in Hebrew. It's Olam Haba. It's not Haolam She'atid Lihiyot. Maybe you meant, is there a distinction between Olam Haba and Le'atid Lavo? That's conceivable. If that's what you mean, yes, there could very well be a distinction between Olam Haba and Le'atid Lavo. Le'atid could be anything beginning with tomorrow. Whereas Olam Haba may begin tomorrow, but that isn't the way in which we customarily look at it. I think that is it. Okay.
Okay, Maya. Thank you so much. Sounds like we're all good here. Thanks, everybody, for the great questions, and hopefully see everybody tonight for Parsha Re'eh. Thank you, Dr. Sokolow, for the great class.
Odesh Tov.
Chodesh Tov, everyone. Enjoy the rain if you're in Toronto.